terrific series, and I'm very pleased to introduce Kirk Goldsberry from UC Santa Barbara. Kirk is all a dissertation. He is a doctoral student in the Department of Geography, and he's also in UCSB's IDIRC in Interactive Digital Media. Kirk is yet another product of Penn State University. We're keeping the Penn State theme going here. In fact, it was really interesting talking to him at lunch about his many academic influences, which include sort of half of our speaker list thus far. Mark Cahagan was his undergraduate thesis advisor, and Rob Edsel was one of your advisors.
One of my TAs and lecturers, yeah.
Okay, one of your TAs. Mark Harrow was one of your TAs.
Right.
And he's also been influenced by Cindy Brewer, so those of you who are in cartography or familiar with the cartographic literature know what a great person Cindy Brewer is. But Kirk is about ready to finish his PhD at UCSB. He's done a great job there. One of the reasons why we wanted to have him speak to share the latest with his dissertation research. He not only has he been doing his research and going through the program there, but he's also soloed a couple of cartography classes at UCSB, so he's had full control of the class as an instructor. This includes the introduction to cartography class, and he's also done a seminar on geovisualization already. Kirk has received the Excellence in Teaching Award from UCSB Geography in 2006. So this is for outstanding everything, outstanding course design, outstanding laboratory activities, outstanding student evaluations. So that is terrific. He's also the recipient of a Dwight D. Eisenhower Transportation Fellowship from the U.S. Department of Transportation, which is a very prestigious, competitive program that awards the quote-unquote brightest minds in transportation science and engineering. So this is another wonderful award for Kirk. He also designs beer labels. We'll get into that later when we go to McMenamin. So I'm very pleased to introduce, and please join me in welcoming Kirk Goldsberry from UCSB.
Thanks for that very kind introduction. And this is a great series you guys have all had a chance to come to, and I'm honored to be a part of it. As Don mentioned, some of the previous speakers have been very influential to me while I was an undergraduate. And since my time at UCSB, I've also had some major influences that I'd be happy to talk to anybody about later on, but we should get started. So Don already did this, but I'm going to do it again. My name's Kirk. Essentially, if you wanted to boil down what I study into one concise bullet point, I study the influence of graphic design variables on travel information, the interpretation of that information, and the subsequent behavior after that interpretation. So one of the things I believe is that the way we design a graphic, in particular a map or a geovisualization, will influence not only the interpretation of that graphic, but that how it's used and how people travel in response to this graphic. So traditionally I'm a geographer, and during grad school I've developed an interest in the transportation science field. So these are the kind of communities I belong to. So in a seminar on geovisualization, I thought I'd put up these main bullet points that highlight the importance of geovisualization and maybe distinguish it a little bit from traditional map making or cartography, and interactivity and the dynamic displays, revealing unknown information from a large data set, the ability to personalize a view and interact with the display. All this might be summed up with the traditional cartographic map reader versus the contemporary geovisualization map user. That's how I perceive it. And I know I listened to the podcast of Rob Edsel, and he was much better at sort of pontificating about this on a conceptual level. You're not going to get that from me, so this was my attempt. Today we're going to talk about geovisualization in the context of traffic maps. And the talk today has four main sections. All right. The generic background, but this will also include a problem statement specific to traffic. data collection strategies, again, specific to traffic. We're going to look at some interesting real-time traffic maps from the internet from around the world cities that have traffic problems. And then the bulk of the talk will be design issues and interesting design decisions associated with traffic maps, keeping in mind that I believe that these little design decisions influence how people interpret these graphics and then respond to these graphics and wayfind in space. So as I said, the problem statement. Automobile congestion is bad and getting worse. Each year, traffic occurs in more places, more often, and during longer parts of every day than ever before. My study area is Los Angeles, which is 100 miles, fortunately, 100 miles away from Santa Barbara. And fortunately, I don't have to drive. A lot of people say, oh, that must be a terrible thing to study traffic in Los Angeles. But I don't have to drive in traffic to research this. But anyway, according to the Urban Mobility Report, which is put out by some transportation scientists at Texas A&M every year, Los Angeles has the worst traffic in the United States. And you might say, oh, well, how do they measure traffic? And how do they say that Los Angeles' traffic is worse than, say, Washington, D.C., which is another city known for really bad traffic? How do they say that? Well, one of these metrics they use is called the travel rate index. And that is a simple ratio that relates a travel time of a certain route during peak conditions and a travel time of that same route during off-peak conditions. And on average, the travel rate index for Los Angeles is 1.75, meaning during off-peak conditions you might go from point A to point B in 40 minutes, and that same drive during peak conditions would then take 70 minutes on average. Okay, so sometimes you'll get lucky and it'll take 52 minutes or 59 minutes. Other times you'll be unlucky and it'll be 84 minutes. But on average, it's 70 minutes, which is the highest such travel rate index of any city in the United States. So this is the area I've chosen to study for this. And as I said, the other thing to consider about that is traffic is occurring in more parts of the day. So we used to have rush hour, the good old days of maybe 1 hour in the morning and 1 hour in the evening called rush hour. Those are gone. Now we have peak conditions. And the point of this last bullet here is to say that those peak condition durations are longer than they were, say, 10 or 20 years ago. So why do I study traffic in the context of geovisualization? Well, traffic is a dynamic and unpredictable and inherently geographic phenomenon. Okay? Unlike traditional cartography, I argue that GeoVis can deal with streaming geographic information pretty easily. And people are interested in traffic information in real time as it streams from the data collection sources. So I'd also like to break this news that only 2 weeks ago, when the President of the United States proposed the 2008 fiscal year budget, he proposed within that a new $175 million highway congestion initiative. And this caught my attention because that strategy would include faster deployment of real-time traffic information. The goals of that initiative are to test new ways to mitigate congestion. Okay, so I assert that providing people with cartographic displays of congestion would fit these new strategies and deployments. I think that since this problem is inherently geographic and inherently streaming, that geovisualization might say, all right, this could be one of these new strategies that we use to at least diagnose traffic and maybe communicate real-time traffic information. So within my PhD research at UC Santa Barbara, the goal might be to create a superior traffic map for Los Angeles. And my idea of a superior traffic map includes enhanced clarity and legibility on small screens, and we'll get into that in a little bit, as well as the improved intuitiveness and graphic efficiency of a really good thematic map. A more conceptual contribution to, say, the cartography community is to really explore the role of human subjects and what's called user-centered design in the HCI community in cartography. And I do lots of human subject experiments and have them do map tasks and respond to the stimuli that are varied based on these design variables that I was talking about earlier and I'll get into later. All right, so I think I hopefully to this point have summed up the traffic problem in the United States, why I think this is important, why I think it relates to geovisualization. The next thing I'd like to talk about is how they're collecting this data, because it's really interesting. And this is a case study in sort of real-time mapping, geovisualization. And to make real-time maps, we need real-time data. And I know I visited with a few scientists today who had a lot of interesting streaming or large data sets, right? So really, this is one of the big fuels for geovisualization is the need to present these large data sets in an intuitive and useful way. And I think, obviously, traffic, real-time data demands a real-time mapping solution. So there's two ways that these data sets come to be when we're talking about automobile congestion or just measuring traffic on a network. And they're differentiated by these terms, macroscopic versus microscopic data collection. And essentially what macroscopic data collection is measuring traffic variables at fixed locations along the network. They use sensors in the road to measure traffic above that sensor location. This is differentiated from microscopic data collection, which instead measures an agent, an individual's progress along a network link. This is being facilitated more and more, this microscopic data collection, by these GPS-armed cell phones with permission. People are measured as they travel through the highway system of large American cities or large foreign cities. And from that, very smart people are putting together databases that are informing us about how that network is performing at that time. Okay, so that's a really different distinction. And the differences in mapping techniques can be traced back to that. I happen to be working with macroscopic data collection strategies. Does anybody know what an inductive loop detector is, or what they are? All right, well, I'll tell you. They're these little buried coils of wire in the pavement, and when a car or an automobile passes over these wires, it disturbs an inductance in the circuit, and the timing of that disturbance can give us the speed of the car. So the slower cars are over disturbing that circuit longer than the faster cars. And then it doesn't take much imagination to say the number of these disturbances over a 5-minute span give us other data that relates to, say, density of traffic. So I have access to this data set that's organized by the California Freeway Measurement Project, which is strangely abbreviated to PEMS. And it's really a combination of people at the University of California, mostly in Berkeley, and people in Sacramento at Caltrans. And Caltrans has installed thousands of these loops detectors all over California freeways. So the raw inductance data is then processed and stored in that streaming database in Berkeley, where they aggregate all this information into 5-minute aggregates. Speed, flow, and occupancy are the three main variables they communicate via text files and FTP. What's important to note, and I'm happy to report, that I have access for my dissertation to the same exact data that what the people at PEMS call value-added resellers use. What does that mean? That means these companies are trying to add value and sell this to people, or put it on the internet and sell ads that are on the margins of the page. So Yahoo, Google, SigAlert, which is something you guys probably don't know up here. It's a very common map and traffic company in Los Angeles, and then traffic.com. So I have this data. This is a macroscopic data set. Microscopic, on the other hand, as I said, measuring individual dynamic agents within a network. Most people agree that this is the wave of the future because it doesn't need as much infrastructure. It's a lower maintenance kind of data collection. We don't need to go in and put all these circuits into the pavement. With our cell phones in our pockets, we can be collecting data hopefully with our consent, but we could be collecting this data. There are privacy issues. I don't want to get into that. There's enough people who are studying that. It's very important. I'll show you a few examples of projects, not necessarily real-time traffic map projects, that are using this microscopic collection. This is an example, a famous study from Baltimore, Maryland. You can see that this was all collected with GPS devices, and they were able to aggregate for the whole spring of 2004 their peak conditions. And you can see right away that you can start diagnosing where these problems are, right? And they were able to do this. For instance, you can see here that this is a bad place to be during peak conditions in Baltimore. And keeping in mind, this is all because of, you know, these GPS collection strategies. MIT has a project that has nothing to do with automobile traffic, just displaying where people are in Rome using these GPS phones. And you can see the city gets populated in the noon and afternoon, and at midnight and at 4 a.m. it's pretty empty. So in general, this is just to remind you that, hey, we have all these data sets that are describing human travel behavior and where they are and when they're there, using existing technologies that most of us already are carrying around in our pocket. This is a terrible graphic to represent this project, but Georgia Tech had a similar project where they had, I think, about 750 to 1,000 participants have GPS in their cars, and every time they turned on their cars, it would record where they went. So all of a sudden, you can start to get all sorts of interesting information. For instance, that people travel 7 miles over the speed limit on average in Atlanta. This is the kind of information you wouldn't get from other, say, surveys where people would tend to say they didn't speed. So anyway, before I get too much into this, that was the traffic data collection part of the talk, and this is the Around the World in Traffic Maps. So let's look at some of these traffic visuals. Have anybody ever used a traffic map to try to navigate through an urban environment? One or two? See, I'm hoping, and all right, I would say about 5 to 10% of you. I think that number needs to go up and will go up in the next 10 years. So traditionally, traffic information has sort of been relegated to radio, especially, you know, the drive time AM radio station has traffic on the sixes or something. More and more people in Los Angeles and other places have television reports alongside their weather forecasts that describe their morning commute or their afternoon commute. This is one major source of factual traffic information. Then we all use what I call these personal traffic mythologies, which I was telling Dawn about at lunch. I've decided that I kind of like the term mental traffic atlas as well, going back to the idea of the mental map in geography. Have we all heard of the mental map? Mental traffic atlas. We all have these ideas, say that it's 3 p.m. on Friday and we need to go to LAX. And we're like, oh, the 405 is going to be backed up. That's a bad time to go. Or conversely, Sunday, 3 a.m., that's not going to be a problem. I'm envisioning the traffic congestion in my head. This is sort of a traffic atlas that people use in urban environments, especially Los Angeles. And you can talk to people and you'll get these different mythologies, depending on who you talk to, about how traffic is going to be, say, the day before Thanksgiving between L.A. and San Diego.
Sure.
I know. I think this is a term that I developed a couple years ago, and I think I'm going to go with mental traffic atlases. Is that better for you? This could be the day where I officially switch. Right. Yeah, it'd be pretty real. Okay, that's all I needed. I'm switching. I'm switching to mental traffic atlas. So the last information resource that people use quite a bit is the internet traffic map, and people are using them sparsely, but more and more every year. One question I had when I started this is, hey, why aren't these the most popular maps in cities? Maybe they could be second behind weather maps, but millions of people every day should be using traffic maps. partially it's because they're not available when people need them most en route. That's a constraint that I see going away. But partially I also think it's because of their design. And let's look around the world and have some opinions here. So this is one of the more common traffic maps for Los Angeles, produced by a company called SigAlert. SigAlert was actually named for a famous radio DJ in the Los Angeles area named Sig or Sigmund. Whenever there was a big incident on the freeways, there would be a SigAlert. And so this company has come out. So that was, he's one of the pioneers of traffic information, we'll say. And SigAlert, that's the derivation of that name. So, what do we think these dots are on the map? Does anybody have a guess why there's a dot here and not there? No? Sensor. Who said that? That's exactly right. Okay, this is a pretty literal representation of the sensor deployment in Los Angeles. And this is just the example of an engineer making a map saying, okay, there's a sensor there, let's put a dot there and code the dot based on the speed that sensor is measuring. And it's not really an attempt to congruently depict traffic as humans cognize it, more as it is, say, an artifact of the collection strategy, that macroscopic collection strategy that I was talking about earlier. So these are sensor locations, there's a dot there. Imagine you were trying to use this map to route from point A to point B. Let's do a quick one here, and you'll see why this is really interesting to me. Let's say we had to go from Encino to Irvine, right? Here's the legend with the speed information. Imagine you had to make a route. Not only did you have to find the fastest route, or the optimal route, so let's say you wanted to get there the fastest, which is not always the case when people are driving, but you also wanted to let the person down in Irvine know when you were going to get there. Okay? So those are two main tasks that people perform with these maps, right? Let me know the way to get there, given these conditions, and two, how long is that going to take? And as you can see, there's these problems. I always say there's two types of congestion on these maps that is depicted. One's intentional, and that's traffic congestion, and then the other one is graphic congestion. And, you know, there's more sensors near these interchanges because that's where the traffic occurs the most, and that's where we're interested in people's driving. But you can start to see in these parts of downtown LA, you have no idea which road this symbol is tied to. Okay. So this is another map of Los Angeles. This is actually created by the people at PEMS, who I think have done a pretty good job, and all they've done here is interpolate between the symbols to create this sort of segment style symbolization. Segments derived from those sensor dots. And I think it's a cleaner map, but still in these areas, what you have is symbols obscuring symbols, and you're not quite sure exactly what's going on. So this is a challenge. Also, when we're going through these maps, I'm going to talk a lot about the legend, because I believe the legend is really a key way to look at a map designer's decisions. So take a look at the legends. An example is this Bay Area map here. And we're getting cut off down here. But you'll notice on this previous example of Los Angeles, numbers, right? The speed. This is the velocity information. And then the folks in the Bay Area, at least the users of this particular map, have what cartographers and some statisticians would term ordinal separation between the classes. For those of you who can't see it, no congestion, heavy, no data, moderate, and stop and go. There's a better example of that in the map I'm about to show. So this is a distinction that we see, and I'd ask you to think about that. I'll address it directly in a minute. This map is also built using those same detectors, obviously set up by Caltrans, that the LA maps use. So you can get different cartographic products using the same data set. Here, this is, Portland. We have the numbers back, and classification is something that I'm going to talk about a lot in a few minutes. So these ordinal terms, one of the problems there is that, particularly in the previous example, I can't go back to it, but it's not quite clear what these terms mean. I might be able to tolerate moderate, I don't know. That might fit with my time budget, maybe it won't. And I don't think that the velocity ranges are much of an improvement over that, but I think giving them the quantity might help them a little bit. I'm not sure where the division between moderate and heavy is, okay? And I'm certainly not sure if heavy is worse or better than stop and go. In this case, I'd venture that it's worse than heavy. But there's ambiguity in this previous example. If you can't see that, stop and go is here. The ordering of the legend doesn't help you at all. But anyway. So this is Seattle, Washington, obviously. They use traffic cameras. Traffic cameras are going to be a thing of the past soon. So from there, we'll go to Tokyo. And has anybody been to the Tokyo airport and seen this sign? This is a sign in the Tokyo airport where they show you, it's a big board, and they show, notice this is what we would call a schematic map, sort of analogous to the famous Beck map of the London Underground. It almost looks like a circuitry diagram more than a map, but it's also very simple to understand this sort of network and how do I get from point A to point B with this type of diagram. Again, even Tokyo is using what I would call the stoplight metaphor. Right? So a lot of these maps are using this metaphor with the symbologies red, yellow, green, because we have this semantic association with the stoplight. Red is stop and green is go. And yellow is, somewhere in the middle. So we'll see that a lot, the stoplight metaphor. And that violates some cartographic principles. Does anybody speak Russian? You do? Do you know what this says? I don't. I think that means slow, and that means kind of slow. But one thing I like about the Moscow map is that they don't just send this barrage of green symbols when everything's okay towards the map reader. There's an evolving or emerging idea with perceptual salience in cartography and thematic relevance and pairing up the most salient elements of a graphic display with what you want the reader to take away the most important, the most prominent piece of thematic information. So when we have maps that show green all over the place as a symbol, it's sort of exclaiming, hey, everything's okay. It'd be analogous to having big loud symbols on a weather map for the weather's normal, like there's no rain. So I think that's an interesting thing that the Russian map shows here. What happens there is then that the incidents in the slower traffic areas are elevated in this visual hierarchy to this place of like, okay, these are significant areas. This, something bad's going on here. This is the Greeks, apparently, not the best traffic mappers, but they have this map for Athens, and they have this interesting legend that's more spectral than sort of a stoplight metaphor, but it also goes from light green to dark red. And again, what you have there is symbols obscuring reference geography and other symbols, so this map is hard to understand. Does anybody speak French? That's more common. What are these, did anybody want to tell me what that means? I still...
Bottleneck.
Bottleneck?
Mm-hmm.
Closed.
Work.
And then the fluid. So again, these are associated with incidents or bottlenecks. But again, that's that ordinal language. It's not necessarily quantitative information that's being displayed, and that might be because they don't have that sensor detection in place. And the last one I wanted to show was London, England, which doesn't have any sensors either. They focus on incidents, and they give the reader a lot of power to turn on and off layers. So that was my sort of world tour of traffic maps to let you know what these things are. And as I said, the bulk of my talk today will have to do with designing these things, keeping in mind that I believe, you don't have to believe, and if you disagree with this, I'd be happy to talk to you about it, that these design decisions, these cartographic or geovisualization decisions, will influence the map interpretation and wayfinding behavior of the agents using these maps on the network. In general, I believe a good display, a good depiction, will facilitate enhanced decision support, and the consequences of a poor depiction or a poor display include suboptimal decision support. So what am I going to talk about? A lot, I said, I look at legends a lot, and I wanted to look at the symbolization, some interpolation stuff, spend a little bit more time on classification and incorporating travel time, and then we'll finally get to the designing for the small screen, which if anybody in here is hoping to be a cartographer for the next 50 years is something we're going to have to deal with. So symbolization of traffic. I call this the stoplight metaphor. This is from your local Portland, Oregon traffic map. And this is the classic stoplight metaphor paired with a classification of velocity data, in this case ratio data. And then here is a more traditional cartography 101 approach to symbolization of this data set. It's interesting because dark relates to less here and light for more, but this is inherent contradiction with traffic. When you talk about more, when you talk about traffic, you're probably talking about more traffic, which would necessarily mean less velocity. So there's this natural contradiction with this statistic that we're using to describe traffic and traffic itself. Whereas the higher we go up on this number line, the lower traffic we're going to have. So this is another interesting thing where we end up reversing the sequential color scheme, which doesn't adhere to the pure principle you'll learn in your textbook. So this is an interesting decision. Another violation of cartographic code here in this legend is the inclusion of red and green in the same color scheme, right? Which is, does anybody know why we shouldn't do that, for instance? Color blindness, right? So we've seen this in almost every example I've showed, and yet some measurable percent of the population will have trouble with differentiating this red and this green. In fact, I think it's the biggest type of color blindness. Is that right, John? All right. So that's interesting. Another nice thing about the sequential scheme, the more adherent to cartographic principle, is that idea of salience. I've done some experiments with my previous advisor, Sarah Fabricant, and she's done a nice job of proving that these darker areas on the map, the darker areas, the thematically relevant in the context of traffic, are going to be more salient. People are going to be drawn to look at those areas first and hold their fixation on those areas and less these light areas, especially when we have a light background, which many of these maps have. So again, that comes back to that idea. I don't want to send a barrage of symbols saying everything's normal here. You know, we don't write home when everything's going just normal in cartography. Okay, so the other big sort of design issue that relates to these detectors, which is the source of all of California's real-time traffic data to this point, is the interpolation. So on the left, we see the literal map where the dots are placed at the central locations, symbolized using that stoplight metaphor. On the right, we see a map that was created with the exact same data set, only with the interpolation. So I would argue that this is a cleaner map than this. And this is sort of, as I said earlier, an artifact of data collection strategies and not an attempt, a good geovisualization attempt, to reflect how people are cognitively thinking about traffic in these networks. All right, so that's interpolation real briefly. This is a more interesting question, I think. So these maps, as I said, could potentially be among the most used maps in the world, maybe not by people here in Corvallis. And if you're not using these maps, that's good. Right? These are not maps that you want to have to use every day, right? So the one question I have is, how do we group this data into classes? Cartographic classification is simply putting data samples into teams, and there are several approaches to that division. I don't really want to get into those. Some emphasize putting equal numbers of observations into one group. Some are more emphasized on equal spacing along the number line. But what is interesting is sort of the exogenous characteristic of traffic. You know, what is a relevant threshold for traffic? If we're going to use velocity as our dominant statistic to determine if something is congested or not, we better do a good job of saying this is a heavy condition, this is a moderate condition, or this is a free flow condition. We don't want people getting told that, hey, there's free flow conditions and they don't think it's free flow, or they get there and it's congested in their minds. So what speed does traffic actually start at? So if there's it, I think we'd all agree that 70 miles per hour average velocity is free flow conditions, and I think we'd also all agree that 0 miles an hour is gridlock, right? So where do we place the thresholds in between there to say, all right, this is a moderate area? Because what's going to happen, as I said, millions of people are going to be using this map. What's going to happen is people are going to start diverting their route or performing these wayfinding operations based on the symbols. And there's a large group of map readers that's going to look at the symbols only and not really look at the numbers. And in the case of some of these where we just have that ordinal language, in other words, moderate, stop and go, heavy, we don't have those numerical ranges. Those people only can rely on the colors. So where we put those thresholds is really an important design decision that's going to influence millions of wayfinders. So let's imagine a three-class traffic map. Red for slow moving, yellow for sort of moderately moving, and green for free flow. Does anybody here want to just volunteer to say what velocity range that yellow middle class should span? It's going to be, okay, that's a very fair question. So it is different for arterials than it is for freeways. I'm more concerned with the freeways, the Interstate 5s of the world, and we have a lot of those, including Interstate 5 in Los Angeles. So let's talk, that's a very good point, let's talk about the interstate / freeway / limited access highways of the world where the speed limit is, say, 65 or 60 miles an hour. So with that revision of this question, where would that yellow class be? There's no right or wrong answer. But what's that? 40 to 60. All right. That's a good. So anything under 60 would get a big yellow symbol on your map, right? Okay, that's fine. So here are the two most common maps I've come across for LA and their classification schemes, all right? 14 miles an hour is the fastest red dot you'll see on the Sig Alert map. 35 miles an hour, or 34 miles an hour, is the fastest red dot you'll see on that. That's a really significant. So, I have done this experiment. If you have two groups of people exposed to the exact same set of traffic conditions, depicted by this classification scheme and depicted by this classification scheme, you can get evidence of behavioral differences caused by this symbol and the class breaks. All right? Why is that important? Well, people are spending hours and hours a year on these freeways and diverting based on these advisories. We can call these maps sort of advisories. It's important that these advisories are consistent with how the people themselves want them to be. So imagine 35 miles an hour. This map says, all right, that's not that severe. In fact, that's the second best you could get, right? 35 miles an hour here is almost the most severe you could get. So this is what I'm talking about. Nobody cares about 70 miles an hour. Everybody's not going to divert. Nobody cares about zero. That's bad. We all know about that. But that interesting area in the middle, and I made this graphic to really try to demonstrate that these are different traffic maps. The three ones that I looked at for one experiment in my dissertation. Transtar is the Houston, Texas real-time traffic map. Sig Alert is the most common one used in LA, and PEMS is the one at UC Berkeley. So imagine this 35 mile an hour speed, which is right here. Okay, you're going to get a lot of different symbolization based on that, and people start behaving differently. Another way to look at it is to eliminate all the junk in between red and green and just look at how big these red and green swaths are. PEMS red and green takes up, 80% or 75% of this number line, whereas the Sig Alert one, not so much. They have a lot of this middle area. So the one thing I demonstrated with some of my research is A, that people are going to behave differently based on the colors they see in this context, which raises the next question, which I think is more difficult. how do we do this? How do we do this right? You can argue, well, everybody wants a different one. All right. But there's a lot of map readers out there who are not in graduate school for geography who don't want to think about classifying maps. So we have to have defaults for a vast majority of these people. The bad news is a lot of mapping systems already give you these color schemes, right? And they do not provide the key to decode the symbols. They're pretty much telling you if it's red, it's bad. And so people are going to divert with no knowledge of really what the quantity they're diverting from is. Conversely, we can imagine somebody getting a green where they would not want to go. So I think this is a really important decision, especially considering that millions and millions of people are making these decisions, say, on these networks every day based on traffic information. So some of the findings from my dissertation as it relates to classification is that people do respond differently based on this. And I have large groups of people behaving differently based on these different classification conditions they were given. And people don't have this mental equation down. I mean, what we're doing with these maps a lot of the time is trying to equate velocity with congestion. And that's pretty weird to do. Congestion is not velocity. They're not the same thing. So we need to think about that. And I think a broader finding of part of my dissertation, at least, is there's this large group of people that just leans on these colored symbols or the classification. It doesn't necessarily mean red, but the three-class severity scale. They're just going to trust that classification. So I think I've done a good job of asserting this a number of times already. It's important that we get these numerical ranges to match up as best we can. It's never going to be perfect with how people are thinking about traffic in this context. Yeah? Well, here's an example of a question I asked about 70 subjects, and I apologize for this. There's three conditions, the Sigler, Transtar, and PEMS condition, each with their own legends that I duplicated. And this is at location W, the raw data value is 33 miles an hour. This is actual traffic data. And these Sigler people were asked to describe the traffic conditions at location W given these five choices. Maybe this will answer your question. If it doesn't, ask me again. And what we found was that despite the raw data value being similar or identical, the response was very different. In fact, the Transtar people all described this, every one of them, as moderate. Whereas the PEMS people, only 2 or 3% described it as moderate. Whereas a lot of people called this heavy, major, and jammed. So they're seeing a bright red symbol because of the classification and the symbolization. So there's sort of a dual influence there. Yeah?
And this is assuming that they're not looking at the legend.
No, they are looking at the legend. Either one. This is like an attempt to mimic actual maps in existence with legends in the form. So if they did take the time to look at the numerical ranges, they would still... This stimuli would be the same. And again, at 34 miles an hour, this group, because of how PEMS has not only classified it, but also symbolized it, and I think it's critical to... I haven't separated those with this particular experiment. I could make more of a sequential identical scheme with different classifications and really isolate that particular influence. This experiment was more meant to emulate the existing maps in the real world. But in the interest of time, the fundamental definition of geographic distance might be the cost of separation between geographic locations. And if that's true, then map makers, I think, have to react to our evolving definition of distance in our society. And more, travelers especially, say, the most dominant cost of separation is not miles anymore. It's travel time. And one thing that, for instance, people say that Portland is about 2 hours away from here, right? We've all heard that said. Current traffic maps, I don't think, are doing a very good job of relating that distance metric. And really, one of the jobs of the map is to inform a reader about distance and direction. That's really what maps help do. And traditional maps congruently relate display geometry with geographic distance. That the expression scale relates those two things, display geometry and geographic distance, right? But sort of as time geography or time distance become more relevant to people in our society, it's important that maps adjust for that. And one way that people have done this in the past are with things called isochrome lines, which are sort of a special type of isolines. This is Bill Bunge's work in Seattle way back in 1966, I think. So this is not new. But this is a really interesting idea that I think could find its place back onto the location-based service or the mobile traffic map of the future. So these are essentially contour lines from, I think that's either the University of Washington or downtown Seattle. So these are only relevant for one point, and it's travel time in, I believe, 5 minute isoline intervals, in this case, minutes. So overlaying isochrome lines essentially boils down to overlaying a depiction of temporal geometry with traditional geographic visualization. And what that does is that facilitates the interaction between two metrics, the space and time distance metrics. And I believe isochrome lines are a really elegant way to depict that. And I'll tell you why I think that's important, and that's because mobility is dependent on both capability and authority constraints, which are two of the fundamentals of the old Hagerstrand paper. Isochrome lines then, because of that, are going to look different for different human beings at different times of the day and in different situations. And geovisualization has the power to say, all right, give me all these parameters and I'll react to those parameters and depict this for an individual. So the term breathing isochrome is sometimes thrown around, and that's meant to imply that variability. You can imagine these things sort of respirating based on the mobility of the user. Maybe they're on a bike or they're on a highway, right? You can imagine them respirating depending on their mobility, depending on traffic conditions along certain links, depending on preferences that I drive 35 miles an hour when the speed limit is 30 or something. So these things are really variable based on the individual, which is the fundamental sort of agent in time geography, right? So that brings us to the last thing I'd like to talk about quickly.
Can I ask you a question also?
Yeah, sure.
With the mobile line, so would it be like it takes 40 minutes to get from the 40 down there to like the next line? Or
it's
like
only relevant for one point. And in fact, I don't think you can do those kinds of calculations, say, from here to here. So the idea being that I think this might be a good thing for a GPS device that knows exactly where in the world you are, because the map and geovisualization in terms of the travel map is really it's going to become more of an individual map. It's about you. So the GPS in the car, I think, is a classic example of this, the in-car navigation system, which has the dot right where you are, right on the right intersection where you are. You could imagine this breathing isochrome that responds to not only your influential preferences, but also the layer of vector geographic information or the terrain information below it if you weren't in a car and you were hiking around some mountains. So what's critical there is that it's only relevant to one exact point, the center of the isochrome line there. So I really do have to hurry up. So all this is well and good, and what geovisualization has done in the last 30 years or 20 years or whenever you want to say it started, we've seen electronic displays become more complex, more user-controlled, more options, more powerful, and all that's really great, and I'm one of those people who's really enjoyed it, but fate has sort of changed the medium on us here at the last minute, or is about to, in my opinion, and that's this emerging era of mobile devices and wireless devices. And many of the future's roadmaps, which is really the area I'm concerned with, I think, is they're going to be consumed on these wireless devices with small screens, at least for a short amount of time before we invent something else. So we've all seen this. Even more challenges for traffic map design result from the design for the small screen. Obviously, we have a less space. Who knows the thing I've been talking about a lot today, what has been removed in the interest of space here. The legend is completely gone for this. This is Google's traffic map, by the way, which I think Google might be a big company capable of finally getting these to penetrate the real market. So it's interesting to note, hey, they don't have a legend at all, which makes that classification discussion I had earlier with you guys even more relevant, in my opinion, because people are just going on symbology and intuition. Obviously, lower screen resolution makes us where we need larger font sizes and larger line weights a lot of the times, dimmer displays, all that cartographic minutia that you're not interested in. Just for the sake of tying this all to where I am in the world, this is this morning's traffic, according to Google's mobile traffic map in Portland. So as it turns out here, there is traffic in Oregon. So I learned twice. I learned last night on the way down here, and I learned when I pulled this image up this morning. And in the interest of time, I'm going to skip my prototype design stuff. All right, so people want these traffic maps in two main situations, pre-trip and en route, right? That's when we want those. And both scenarios depend on the internet. Current maps are largely relegated to traditional PCs, aren't designed well even for that. But as we move to wireless and mobile devices, we need to really enhance our design so that these things perform for us. And I would separate, I have a paper that talks about those in detail. But I'd like to conclude so we have time for questions here. Design decisions, this is really a broad conclusion, I know, but it's sort of one of my central theses and driving forces of all my research, is that the design decisions for the graphic variables that we control as geovisualization experts and or cartographers and or GIS users not only influences human travel behavior, but just general map interpretation and that subsequent map use, the things that people actually do with these maps are influenced by how we symbolize or how we classify or how we draw a line. And I think those empirical demonstrations of that really help provide insight to how cartographers and geovisualization folks can help by providing improved decision support once we know what people are looking for with these maps. I believe that justifies this user-centered design component. Really testing your design, sort of like human-computer interaction people might suggest for testing an interface, testing these geovisualization displays to see how people are reacting to them before you just go out there and throw it on SigAlert.com. One interesting application of these findings, I think we might be able to tailor a cartographic strategy to help optimize an agent's behavior within the network. For example, if we learn that one depiction of traffic conditions will result in 25% of users diverting off their route, and another depiction of the exact same condition will result in 40% of people diverting, you can start to see the merit and utility of using these different depiction strategies to help optimize network performance. Right, and that's a pretty new concept to me that I'm toying with for the next phase of my research, is trying to tailor these research or these design variables almost to act like these voodoo agents on human beings so that they behave the way we want them to. We have a large sample of readers and we need 30% of them to do this, at least to optimize network performance. We might be able to do that with map design, or at least contribute. And with that in mind, I think geovisualization as a component of GI science can help enhance these roadmaps of the future, because the engineers that are, for instance, designing a lot of the traffic maps could use our input. And with that said, I would like to thank, before I finish, the department here and Dr. John Wright, who's been very helpful, and the Faculty Development Fund, and of course your Iger, which helped get me and all the other wonderful speakers here for this series. So thank you. I'll be happy to take questions at this time. That's a really good point. A lot of people ask me that all the time. Why aren't you routing these people or providing them with routing options? And one of the reasons I say for that is when people get a bad route or when they have a bad experience with the routing engine, they often throw out the whole system. And I always use the example of my parents who call their in-car navigation system the GPS. And everything that happens with that is related to one thing. They're not just related. They don't separate the cartography from the satellite hardware. They don't separate the GIS or the vector data quality to anything. If something goes wrong, that whole system is at fault. So some behavioral geography, in fact, Reg Gollidge, I think, has done a good job of suggesting that when you route people, it's really dangerous that they're going to start doubting the whole system. I don't know if I believe that or not. I think that providing a series of routes is a good option, especially as you mentioned a series of routes, alternatives. But I do think maybe a better criticism of routing and time estimates in that regard is just because there's no traffic at point A now doesn't mean there's not going to be traffic there in 10 minutes or 45 minutes. So then you have to come back with a forecasting model of traffic. And there's people at Berkeley who are forecasting traffic all over the place, and all these different models for forecasting traffic. And I think that is where the isochron visualization could pair, you could couple those two. So not only do I know where I'm going to be in 10 minutes, I'm going to know what the traffic is there like in 10 minutes. And that's where that isochron becomes even more elegant, because it's giving me a visual cue as to, oh, I'm going to be there in 10 minutes and it's going to look like this. Now that brings in all sorts of uncertainty associated with the prediction. Yeah.
Yeah, with this, you're talking about the forecasting now. In the past, because you don't have instant feedback, now you can actually base that on how many people are browsing that particular route.
Right.
That is, you can actually derive a very good estimate.
Yeah. And I believe that's a complete other really good dissertation that I'm not going to write. It's on forecasting models for traffic. I don't know. Who wants to go? Now, I called on you accidentally. And okay, you go.
I wanted to ask you, in your team, have you considered air quality conditions, to match air quality conditions depending on these travel times, traffic conditions?
I've never done that, but I think it's a really valid justification for my research for the environmental community. So.
The other question is, could you explain or explain where, how the experiment, the behavior experiment you have done?
Yeah.
I wonder, because you mentioned that there were 70 people
right.
in the experiment, and I would like to know if you are going to do a quarter ratio.
Yeah.
Since this would be a larger population.
I've actually done several experiments, and I don't really want to get into the design. I'd be happy to tell you afterwards about how I designed those experiments and what the future of those experiments is, but yeah, in front.
You talked about the symbology and on the legend. One of the things
came up before is that it depends sort of on the type of street and the speed limit on the different types of street.
Exactly.
Has anyone explored maybe a ratio of, you know, the speed on this street is 85% of the speed limit. Okay, now that's a green, whereas maybe
right.
it's 60% of the speed limit. Okay, now we're getting
Yeah, that would be another way you could determine traffic. I know the transportation, it's hard to find somebody who's bold enough to be like, congestion starts at this. But the transportation community, some people at least agree that it's 45 miles an hour on an access road. That's when we have congested conditions. So that might be 45 65ths or 45 60ths, depending on where in the country you are, or 45 70ths, if you're in West Virginia, or 45 over zero, if you're in Montana, or undefined.
I think of just, if you're going to downtown LA, the expectation on the surface street in downtown is different than the expectation on the 101.
Right.
So maybe a ratio that
Well, the travel rate index, which I brought up earlier, is something I might explore in that very context. So looking at individual links in a network, saying normally at off-peak times, it's 10 minutes to get from Hollywood to Santa Monica. But right now, it's 25 minutes. That's a 2.5. I might be like, oh, that's really bad. That might be another interesting way to communicate that, which is really similar to what you're saying. Yeah, I agree.
So there's a really strong analogy between what you're talking about, this idea of perception.
Yeah. No, that's exactly another thing that I've thought about in depth. In fact, is okay. My commute home is normally 30 minutes, and I take the same trip every day. For example, the thing that person might want to know most is exactly how much is it deviating from my mean travel time home, and I think that might be the so that gets into compartmentalizing the people who are on the freeway system. And that's saying the people who drive every day might want this statistic. The people who have never been through this part of the freeway might not care that it's abnormally congested or not. They just want to know the travel time that day because they're unfamiliar. So then you start looking at behavioral geography again in that human context. But I believe that you might have different metrics for different people, different types of travel, whether you're going on the weekend to drive to a hike or whether you're going to work every day.
In the same way that you display climate data on the internet, there's some way of website. Do you want to see the temperatures, or do you want to see the temperature in home, but you click the radio button, or whatever you choose?
No, I think that's a very good comment. I think I would include that in my ideal system.
I'm going to cut you off, Andrew. Unfortunately, I think we need to make that the last question, but Kirk will be here for up to 20, 25 minutes. So please come up and talk to Kirk. And those of you who are graduate students who want to go to McMenamin's and going to the dinner, please do so. And Kirk, we present each of our speakers with the geovisualization poster and with your OSU Geosciences Club cap. So you are now a beaver, whether you want to be or not. Thank you very much, Florian.
Also, my collaborator Julie Dillon is going to be here next week. She's very good, so come say hi to her and just be nice. Thank you.